Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Friday, April 21st, 2023. Florida's Republican Governor Ron DeSantis promoting his vision of a conservative agenda in a speech to the Heritage Foundation's Leadership Conference. He also tells the group, "We've been able to operate an administration that does not get consumed in petty controversy or drama or palace intrigue. We basically execute the mission day after day after day." Perhaps a reference to Donald Trump, who he would meet in a Republican primary if he decides to run for president. President Joe Biden signing an executive order that would make the pursuit of environmental justice, as the White House puts it, part of the DNA of every federal agency. State Department not commenting on a report that now Secretary of State Antony Blinken was behind the effort in the run-up to the 2020 election to discredit potentially damaging information on Hunter Biden's laptop as Russian disinformation. Plus, the latest from Sudan and U.S. preparations to evacuate U.S. embassy workers from that country's capital city if the intense fighting between the Sudanese army and a rebel group gets any worse. And in Great Britain, the Deputy Prime Minister Dominic Raab resigns after an investigation found he bullied other government officials. And now to Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, a Republican, speaking at the Heritage Foundation's Leadership Summit held at National Harbor, Maryland, just south of Washington, D.C. Reuters reports that Ron DeSantis, who is expected to run for the 2024 Republican presidential nomination, is set to begin a trip abroad on Saturday, taking him through Japan, South Korea, Israel, and the United Kingdom. The article says while the trip is officially billed as a trade mission, the tour is widely seen as an attempt to burnish his foreign policy credentials in the lead-up to an official announcement expected in the late spring or early summer. After Ron DeSantis' speech today at Heritage, he was asked a couple of questions by the group's president, Kevin Roberts.
Yesterday, President Biden was in the news about energy policy, the Climate Action Fund, and how the United States is committed to that. Would you connect the dots, and I think people know this, but just we want to hear you explain this to us, connect the dots between that and self-governance for the individual American. Why is the left so focused on what they call climate policy?
Yeah, look, I think it's a pretext to be able to advance more control over our society and advance an ideological agenda. I mean, if you think of the people that are always talking about global warming and all this stuff, has there ever been one policy that they recommended that did not perfectly dovetail to what left-wingers want to do anyways? No. And it's also an issue in terms of self-government of a lot of this stuff is being imposed through executive fiat. If you look at what they're trying to do now with remaking how cars are done and all this, nobody ever voted for that. You look at some of the things internationally that they want to impose, they're not going to get that ratified through the United States Senate. So it really flows from massive bureaucracy, you know, more power in the executive and being able to basically unilaterally impose major changes to society, which ultimately bode very ill for our freedoms.
Thanks, Governor. The advice question is just a brief preface. Is we've been doing some research at Heritage about people wanting to be optimistic about the future, and they're optimistic because of what you and, thank God, many other elected officials are doing. And yet our research shows that probably if you polled this audience, people watching, they would describe themselves as bearing a burden, you know, joyfully because of their faith, because of their belief in the United States. The advice from you that we're seeking as governor, as a dad, as a husband, what do we need to do in our individual lives? When all of these friends go home, they know they have faith in you and many elected officials. What can they do to help save this country?
Well, I think, you know, Florida shows that, you know, it can be done. As we took a state that was a swing state and we've basically moved people in our direction. Honestly, like, I'm happy with what we've done and I had to stand up for a lot of stuff, but the left kind of helps us because it's just insane what they're trying to do. So just being a voice of Sandy makes a big difference. But nothing, when you have a situation where you have that agenda is permeated every institution in society, you are going to face blowback if you stand for traditional principles, traditional values. That's just the reality. It's not just me being a governor, parent going to a school board meeting, us trying to speak the truth. Do you think the media is going to write a glowing profile of a conservative mom doing that? No, they're going to attack you. The left's going to come after you. So standing up for what's right in our country in this day and age is not cost-free. So you just need to understand that. But I think you've got to be willing to accept that. And when I come into this part of the country, sometimes when you're flying into Reagan Airport, you fly parallel to the National Mall. And it's always great. You know, look at the left side of the plane. You see Lincoln Memorial, Reflecting Pool, all these great monuments, the Capitol Building. And it's like, oh, man, that's what America's all about, those ideas. And I used to do that as a U.S. congressman. But then I figured out the view was much better out the right side of the plane because you looked over the Potomac River, very small monuments arranged very orderly over rolling hills in a place called Arlington National Cemetery. And the connection between those two is you can have the best Declaration of Independence in the world, you can have the best Constitution in the world, you could have great political leaders. None of that will amount to much if you don't have people that are willing to stand up, put on that uniform, risk their lives, and even give the last full measure of devotion. And so that was what I really believed, you know, America was all about. We're not asked to give such a sacrifice amongst ourselves, what those folks did. But we are asked to sacrifice. And I think the way you do it is you just wear it as a badge of honor. When they come after me, I just take it to know I must be on the right track and keep trudging ahead.
Governor Ron DeSantis, Republican from Florida, at the Heritage Foundation Conference in Maryland today. A new Wall Street Journal poll finds that in a hypothetical matchup for the Republican presidential nomination against declared candidate Donald Trump, among Republican primary voters, Donald Trump beats Ron DeSantis 51-38%. A lot of news sites on Thursday night reported that President Joe Biden tentatively plans to announce his reelection campaign next week, starting with a video on Tuesday. All those news sites citing anonymous sources who were briefed on the plans. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre saying today that she's aware of the news reports, but the law will prevent her from saying much more.
I just want to say one last thing, and I know there's a lot of interest in this, obviously. I totally understand this. A lot of questions about all of this, the press reports that we have seen the last 24 hours when it comes to the president's plans for 2024. I just want to say, and I know all of you in this room know this, I understand that you all know this, but there might be some folks who are watching at home who may not know. And so just want to lay this out for all of them. As a government employee, federal law prohibits me from discussing campaign-related topics from this podium. So I will be following that law and not discussing anything regarding the 2024 race. The president has been very clear. I know you all have reported this many times, and he has said this in many multiple interviews over the past several months with multiple outlets. And on his attentions what his attentions are and when it comes to 2024. But beyond that, I will not be able to comment on anything, again, related to the 2024 elections.
White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre. From Politico, advisors had originally looked at an April launch date, noting that President Barack Obama picked that month to announce his own reelection, but then toyed with moving it up following President Biden's State of the Union address in February. Recent discussions in Biden world slid the launch to later in the spring or summer, but April 25th, the anniversary of President Biden's 2019 announcement, long stood as an informal target. Making the announcement in a low-key video message with fundraising solicitation would echo how the Obama-Biden ticket unveiled its bid in 2011. That from Politico. President Biden today signing an executive order that, according to the White House, directs federal agencies to invest in disadvantaged communities disproportionately affected by pollution and climate change. The order would create a new Office of Environmental Justice in the White House to coordinate all environmental justice efforts across the federal government and require agencies to notify nearby communities if toxic substances are released from a federal facility. The president spoke today in the White House Rose Garden.
Earth Day is tomorrow, a chance to reflect on the national wonders of our nation and our planet. But we have to do a great deal more than just reflect. We have to commit ourselves to action. Will we step up to our ambitions? Will we stand together to meet the great challenges we have? Will we preserve our planet for future generations? History is going to judge us by how we answer these questions. And that's not hyperbole, that's a fact. And today, I hope the answer is going to be a loud and clear yes. Yes, we're committed to following the science. Yes, we're determined to strengthen the ambitions and our ambitions and actions. And yes, we will include communities that have been denied basic security, basic dignity that comes from clean air, having clean air, clean water, and clean energy jobs and environmental justice.
President Biden in the White House Rose Garden. CNBC writes, communities of color across the U.S. are systematically exposed to higher levels of air pollution than white communities because of federal housing discrimination, according to research published in the journal Environmental Science and Technology Letters. Black Americans are 75% more likely than white Americans to live near facilities that produce hazardous waste, according to the Clean Air Task Force, and are three times more likely to die from exposure to air pollutants. More from President Biden on his executive order.
Under this order, environmental justice will become the responsibility of every single federal agency. I mean, every single federal agency. That means every federal agency must take into account environmental and health impacts on communities and the work to prevent those negative impacts. Environmental justice will be the mission of the entire government, woven directly into how we work with state, local, tribal, and territorial governments. This is an order that directs the federal agencies to address gaps in science and technology. For example, there's a lot we still don't know about the quality of people's wastewater or the air they're breathing. There's still a lot we don't know about the cumulative impacts of pollution on people's health. We need to learn more so we can serve those communities better and help the world overall. And this executive order creates a new Office of Environmental Justice and a new role for the Chief Environmental Justice Officer. They will coordinate all our efforts across government to make sure we're delivering the greatest possible benefits to people's lives. This executive order honors and builds on decades of work, including by many of you who are here today in the private as well as public sector. In two years, we're making real progress in the most ambitious environmental justice agenda in history. And with this executive order, we'll go even further.
President Biden in the White House Rose Garden. He also again criticized House Republicans for their plan to raise the national debt limit to avoid default while at the same time cutting federal spending, including repealing electric vehicle and other clean energy tax incentives under the Inflation Reduction Act. This is Washington Today. House and Senate not in session in Washington, D.C. today for business, but the House Ways and Means Committee held a field hearing in Peachtree, Georgia. Testimony from the owners of small businesses, including a supplier of electrical contact materials and an accounting firm, and Coach's Bar and Grill, which the committee says is known for its tasty wings. Congressman Jason Smith, Republican from Missouri, is the committee chair.
The small businesses across Georgia and the United States have been battling on the front lines of the Biden economy for the past 2 years. Historic inflation, higher interest rates, and help wanted signs have come to define life in America for millions of people and businesses. For a lot of folks in this room, it feels like Washington has forgotten about them. We need to prioritize the families, the farmers, and small businesses who build, feed, fuel, and power our nation. Since President Biden took office, the average American household has lost $10,000 due to higher prices on everything from food to gas to clothes. Real wages are down 3.5%. And for working class families, it means choosing between gas in your car and food on your table. Here in Georgia, gas prices alone have increased by over 50%, rising from just $2.16 in January of 2021 to over $3.38 today. 64% of Americans are now living paycheck to paycheck. For a record 24 straight months, inflation-adjusted wages are down. Labor force participation still has not caught up to where it was before the pandemic. High interest rates are making it harder for small businesses to expand, invest, and create jobs. President Biden's proposed $4.7 trillion in new taxes is not the solution. Welfare for the wealthy and job-killing green energy regulations are not the solution either. The best investment Congress can make is in the American worker and small businesses. And that is where we are focused today.
Congressman Jason Smith, Republican from Missouri, chair of the House Ways and Means Committee, at the field hearing today in Peachtree, Georgia. Congresswoman Suzanne DelBene, Democrat from Washington State, defended the policies of the Biden administration and congressional Democrats and said it's the Republican plans that will cause economic harm.
The impact of Democrats' economic plan is in the data. 236,000 jobs were created in March. 236,000 jobs were created in March. Over 12 million jobs have been created over the past 2 years. The unemployment rate is down to 3.5%. Real GDP increased at an annual rate of 2.6% in the fourth quarter of 2022 and 3.2% in the third quarter. But all that work is now under threat by House Republicans. Let me be clear, the greatest threat to economic security of Georgians and families across the South right now is Republicans' extreme policies. This week, Speaker McCarthy finally unveiled his so-called plan to raise the debt ceiling. This bill would kill thousands of jobs, gut programs families rely on, accelerate the climate crisis, and undo much of the progress over the last 2 years. Meanwhile, President Biden's plan would make the investments we need in our future while cutting the deficit by nearly $3 trillion over the next decade. The right way to avoid a default is to pass a clean debt ceiling increase. My colleagues and I are open to finding a bipartisan path forward on funding the government and lowering the deficit. But we've also been clear, and we can't have these discussions if Republicans are going to hold our economy hostage. There is a bipartisan path forward on growing our economy and on growing the middle class.
Suzanne DelBene, Democrat from Washington State, at the Ways and Means Committee hearing held today in Peachtree, Georgia. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, Republican from California, tweeting today, President Biden is giving our national debt the same treatment he gives the crisis on our southern border. Ignore it and hope it goes away. Each day, this lack of leadership brings us one step closer to the first default in our nation's history. Wall Street today, the Dow up 22, S&P up 3, NASDAQ up 12. From Fox News, the State Department on Friday refused to answer questions about a claim from a former CIA official that Antony Blinken, now President Biden's Secretary of State, led efforts in 2020 to have intelligence officials write a letter that said the Hunter Biden laptop story was part of a Russian disinformation campaign. The House Oversight and Accountability Committee said Thursday that former CIA Deputy Michael Morell told the committee that Secretary Blinken was the impetus for the letter that was ultimately signed by 51 current and former intel officers. That letter said stories about Hunter Biden's laptop were a Russian ploy, a claim that was later shown to be false. Republicans say the now discredited letter was orchestrated in order to help deflect from criticism then-candidate Joe Biden, as the Hunter Biden laptop revealed messages that pointed to efforts by the Bidens to trade on their name. That from Fox News. Questions about this today to the State Department spokesperson Vedant Patel.
Did the Secretary dispute the accuracy of the GOP letter sent to him on Hunter Biden? And then does he also plan to comply and respond to it by May 4th deadline?
That is a not a State Department issue, so I don't have a comment for you on that.
Do you know if he was asked about it, if he asked the State Department to provide him to comment on this letter?
And it's not clear who else outside of the department we can ask, given it did happen before he was Secretary of State.
It is not a State Department issue, and I don't really have a comment on this from the State Department.
State Department spokesperson Vedant Patel at a briefing. The House Judiciary Committee and Intelligence Committee chairs have sent Secretary Blinken a letter requesting information concerning the Hunter Biden emails. Judiciary Committee Chair Congressman Jim Jordan, Republican from Ohio, was interviewed on Fox News Thursday night.
When the story came out on October 14th, 2020, about the Biden business operation and was then Vice President Joe Biden involved, there was some concern that he was. And then quickly it turns into this political operation, that letter that became the basis for suppressing the story and keeping it from the American people just days before the most important election we have, election for president of the United States. So understand what happened, Laura. The 14th, the Post does a story. The 17th, Tony Blinken, senior advisor to the Biden campaign, current Secretary of State, contacts Mike Morrell, gets him interested in this. Mike Morrell looks at it the next day, organizes on the 18th. All these other people to sign the letter. The 19th, the letter goes out. And then on the 22nd, and the reason Mike Morrell said he did the letter was he thought President Trump would bring the issue up during that debate on the 22nd of October. And of course he did. And they wanted some statement that Joe Biden could use. Because as Mr. Morrell said, they wanted him to win.
Yeah,
and what
well,
happens on the 22nd?
Yeah.
Joe Biden brings it up. And then after that debate, here's the kicker. Steve Ricchetti, chair of the Biden campaign, calls up Mike Morrell and thanks him for doing it all. It was a total political operation. And the most important fact is, Laura, it was false. It wasn't Russian disinformation.
Yeah.
The laptop story looks to be true.
Congressman Jim Jordan, Republican from Ohio, Judiciary Committee chair on Fox News Thursday night. The African American Mayors Association held a conference in Washington today. One panel included the Big Four, as they called them, the mayors of New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, and Houston, the largest cities in the United States, and for the first time, all four have mayors who are African American. They talked about policies from job creation to combating homelessness and crime and gun violence. And during the discussion, New York Mayor Eric Adams was asked about his governing style.
Define the swag and how it influenced your work as mayor. And I think I know when I see it. But can you please help me define it for me?
And that's so important because I'm the mayor of the city of New York. I was in Qatar the other day and he said, and the mayor stated that there's America and then there's New York City. And what people expected, they expected me to fit in. Like being the mayor, being of the borough president, of being a state senator, being a captain in the police department, that's my glory. That's not my story. My story is being dyslexic and bullied as a child. My story is being arrested and beat by police officers. My story is being rejected. And so when I came here and became the mayor, it's not because I came from a family of prestigious people. I came from a mom that cleaned houses. And so when you could have someone that's arrested, rejected, dyslexic, and now I'm elected to be the mayor of the most powerful city in the country, you walk differently.
Yeah.
You know, you walk, you know, you got this.
Yeah. Wow. No. That's good, man. That's good.
How could you not have a level of, you sit in front of all of these people who wake up every day praying and hoping that I can fail. They watch me navigate the COVID crisis. They watch me navigate 52,000 people coming into our city without one penny from the federal government. They watch me decrease crime in my city, deal with homelessness in my city. The bond ratings, Fitch, raise our bond to a double A. I'm the CEO of the largest corporation in America, and my bald head, earring wearing swagger is running this city my way.
Yeah, yeah,
my way.
Yeah.
That's swag.
Yes, sir.
New York Mayor Eric Adams, a Democrat at the African American Mayors Association Conference in Washington, D.C. Their website lists 127 active members. Washington Today continues in a moment. Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts and on the C-SPAN Now mobile app. From Associated Press, the Pentagon has deployed forces and is developing options to assist in the possible evacuation of U.S. Embassy personnel from Sudan. But the White House said Friday there are no plans for now for a broader pullout of the potentially thousands of other Americans from the African country where warring factions are in a violent conflict. Reporters asking the National Security spokesperson John Kirby about this during a virtual briefing.
Are we looking at a likely evacuation of American diplomatic personnel in Sudan soon?
Well, Steve, we want to be ready for that eventuality if it comes to that. We are pretty much in the same place that we were yesterday. The military continues to pre-position capabilities nearby in case they're needed, but there has not been a decision made that they will be needed. It's just a matter of making sure that we're ready for it. Still a very tense situation in Khartoum. None of these so-called ceasefires have taken root for very long. So the fighting continues. It is not a safe environment at all there in Khartoum. So we just want to make sure that we're ready. Part of that readiness has been, as all of you know, over these last many months to warn Americans through travel advisories not to travel to Sudan, and if they're in Sudan, to leave Sudan. And right now, we would advise any Americans who are particularly in Khartoum to take care of themselves, to find shelter, safe haven, and stay put. This is not the time to be moving around the country. If you didn't abide by our strong warnings to leave.
And are you thinking about just American diplomats pulling them out, or American citizens, everyone? I mean, it sounds like there are thousands of Americans there.
Yeah, look, I mean, as I think we've said many times, there's no higher priority than the safety of our U.S. Government personnel and their families that are serving our country overseas. We've made it clear to both sides that any attacks or threats or dangers posed to our diplomats are totally unacceptable. And as I said earlier, the U.S. Africa Command, the Department of Defense, and of course the State Department is monitoring the situation. And again, they're conducting prudent planning for contingency operations. As a part of that planning, as I said, there's some additional capabilities being deployed nearby to the region, just in case they're needed to secure and potentially facilitate the departure of U.S. Embassy personnel from Sudan. Again, only if circumstances require it.
John Kirby, the Strategic Communications Coordinator with the National Security Council, taking reporters' questions during a virtual audio briefing today. More from the Associated Press article. An estimated 16,000 private U.S. citizens are registered with the U.S. Embassy in Khartoum as being in Sudan. The State Department has cautioned that that figure probably is inaccurate because there is no requirement for Americans to register, nor is there a requirement to notify the embassy when they leave. And the U.S. State Department said Friday that an American citizen had died in Sudan but did not have further details. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, questioned by a reporter about the planning for a possible evacuation from Sudan during a news conference today in Germany.
Looking at the current crisis in Sudan, what lessons learned from the Afghanistan evacuation are shaping your efforts to prepare to get U.S. Embassy staff out of Sudan, and has the State Department asked you to begin that process?
The Department, through our headquarters at AFRICOM, continues to monitor very closely the situation on the ground, and we continue to coordinate with the State Department to make sure we have a common vision of what the situation is. We always want to make sure that we're doing prudent planning, which is what we're doing. We've deployed some forces theater to ensure that we provide as many options as possible if we are called on to do something, and we haven't been called on to do anything yet. No decision on anything has been made. And for operation security purposes, as you would guess, I won't specify, you know, where those troops move to and But our focus is to make sure that we continue to do prudent planning and that we create and maintain as many options for our president as possible.
Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin. From Reuters, Sudan's army said it had agreed to a three-day truce starting on Friday to enable people to celebrate the Muslim holiday of Eid al-Fitr following almost a week of fighting between its troops and a rival paramilitary force. Secretary of Defense Austin's news conference today was in Germany. He was joined by General Mark Milley, chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. They were there attending a meeting of the allies who support Ukraine in the war against Russia. During his opening statement, Secretary Austin brought up an issue that some have suggested could be a point of contention among those allies when it comes to Ukraine: the classified Pentagon documents, which were leaked and show intelligence assessments on the state of the Ukraine war, and also that the U.S. was doing surveillance on adversaries and some friends.
Let me say just a few words about the reports of unauthorized disclosure of sensitive and classified U.S. material. I take this matter extremely seriously, and we will continue to work closely with our deeply valued allies and partners in a spirit of abiding respect and friendship. As I've discussed this issue with our allies and partners, I've been struck by their solidarity and their commitment to reject efforts to divide us. So nothing will fracture our unity or reduce our determination.
Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin at the 11th meeting of the Ukraine Defense Contact Group at Ramstein Air Base in Germany. That suspect in the Pentagon documents leak case remains in jail. He was to have a second court appearance this week, but his lawyers requested and were granted an extension. U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas giving a speech and an interview today at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington. He covered border security and immigration, foreign terrorism, domestic terrorism, cybersecurity, and other homeland security issues. One reporter in the audience asked him about his recent testimony before House and Senate committees and how he has been treated by some members of Congress.
Hi, I'm Rebecca with The Hill. I wanted to ask you about your appearances before Congress this week on a more personal level. Republicans are increasingly commenting on your personal character during these hearings. I was curious how you feel about those comments and what's going through your mind during some of these exchanges.
Well, I would say
this is on the record.
You know, they are not easy to listen to. They also have ramifications that I wish individuals in positions of leadership would consider. Because our work is about people. And it's about the people doing the work, the people affected by the work, about our institutions, our norms, our definition as a country of values and principles. I am fundamentally, though, I'm impervious to them, because I may make some mistakes, but my decisions may be mistaken. Some may disagree with them, but I have 100% confidence in the integrity of my decision making.
Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington today. C-SPAN cameras were there. You can find the full program at cspan.org. Washington Post reports that Alejandro Mayorkas said Thursday that the Biden administration plans to announce preparations across the U.S.-Mexico border next week in anticipation of an influx of migrants after the White House lifts pandemic-related restrictions on May 11th. From Great Britain, BBC News writes that Dominic Raab has resigned as Deputy Prime Minister after a bullying inquiry found he acted in an intimidating and aggressive way towards officials. The inquiry by a senior lawyer was set up by Prime Minister Rishi Sunak after 8 formal complaints about Mr. Robb's behavior as a minister. Mr. Robb said the inquiry was flawed and sets a dangerous precedent. That from BBC News. Dominic Robb was interviewed by the BBC.
Isn't the blunt truth when you read all of this report that a fair-minded person reading it would conclude that, I mean, to be crude, that you're a nightmare to work for?
Well, actually, almost all of the complaints against me were dismissed. And what this doesn't give you, it's a handful of very senior officials. None of the junior complaints were upheld. And I got on and dealt with hundreds of civil servants, thousands of other people in prison service and the court service. And what you've got is the risk here, a very small minority of very activist civil servants with a passive-aggressive culture of the civil service who don't like some of the reforms, whether it's Brexit, whether it's parole reform, whether it's human rights reform, effectively trying to block government. That's not on. That's not democratic.
Former British Deputy Prime Minister Dominic Robb, member of the Conservative Party, interviewed by the BBC today after his resignation following that report that he had engaged in bullying. British Labour Party leader Keir Starmer, the main opposition party, was interviewed by the newspaper The Independent.
Is the continual weakness of the Prime Minister, because there's a double weakness here. He should never have appointed him in the first place, along with other members of the cabinet that shouldn't have been appointed. And then he didn't sack him. And even today, it's Robb who resigns rather than the Prime Minister who acts. And I think, you know, we're here at Middlesbrough College. I've been talking to the next generation of NHS staff. They desperately want to talk about the future of the NHS. And here we are talking about these weaknesses at the top of the Tory party. And I think, you know, in the end, after 13 years, it just demonstrates that you, no matter how many times you change the person at the top, you've essentially got a party that just can't deliver, just can't govern.
British Labour Party leader Keir Starmer in an interview today. New York Times reports that Dominic Robb is the third cabinet minister in 6 months to leave over ethics issues, illustrating again the difficulty Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has had in delivering his promise to lead a government of integrity, professionalism, and accountability at every level. This weekend is the annual Los Angeles Festival of Books, the largest literary event in the United States. C-SPAN's Book TV will have live coverage Saturday starting at 1:30 p.m. Eastern from the campus of the University of Southern California. It will be live on C-SPAN Radio, C-SPAN 2 Television, streamed at cspan.org, and on our mobile app, C-SPAN Now. Highlights will include interviews and live viewer and listener call-ins with LA Times executive editor Kevin Merida and writer Beverly Gage, author of G-Man, and Tolu Olorunipa, author of His Name is George Floyd. A few weeks ago, C-SPAN spoke with LA Times Festival of Books organizer Ann Binney.
How many authors are you expecting this year?
Over 550. So it's getting up there. We're almost done. I think when all is said and done, I think we're going to be at over 550 authors.
Well, Ann Binney, anybody who's organized an event knows that, sure, you can have the people there, but there is so much work being done under the surface, tents, security, et cetera, correct?
Oh, absolutely. We have a team of people that build the whole thing out at USC. Our partners at USC, we have lots of people on campus who we work with all the different departments, as you said, from security and transportation and all the things that go into it to make sure that campus is ready for this influx of people, both in terms of all the exhibitors we have. We have over 300 exhibitors from the community that are going to set up booths on campus and then bring in, you know, as we talked about, bringing in all the authors. So it's a huge operational apparatus that we're working on right now.
And what's it been like to have a big university like the University of Southern California as a partner?
Oh, they've been wonderful. We work closely with them. We meet with them regularly. As I said, we work with all the various departments that work on this event in order to have it take place on their campus. It's a large campus, and we take up a good part of it with the event. And they also have a stage and a room that that they also program. So we have an outdoor stage, a really wonderful outdoor stage where we have bands and performances from USC students. And then we also have a panel room that USC programs themselves, and they feature professors throughout the weekend as well, having conversations of importance to the community, to the university. And then they also have another stage that's a slightly smaller stage where they have children's literacy events, readings, and different performances for the community. It's called the Friends and Neighbors stage. So they have a big presence in the programming as well.
Los Angeles Times Festival of Books organizer Ann Binney on a C-SPAN About Books podcast from a few weeks ago, previewing the festival, which begins Saturday, April 22nd, live coverage at 1:30 p.m. Eastern on C-SPAN's Book TV, on C-SPAN Radio, C-SPAN 2 Television, C-SPAN.org, and on our mobile app, C-SPAN Now. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Sign up for C-SPAN's evening newsletter Word for Word to get the stories Washington is talking about sent to your inbox every day. Subscribe at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night and weekend.